what's happening, if anything.
I mean, taking the tour is like something pretty simple that you could do, and like the higher your social status is, the better it's going to be for you to take tours through there. And I don't know what else. I mean, there needs to be some kind of jail support. Like, since I've gone in and out of the jail so many times, I've seen so many things that are so dangerous. Like, I've seen them dump a guy in a wheelchair out into freezing cold, an elderly disabled guy. I've seen like really cognitively impaired young people come out of jail that could get a predator could get really easy, you know. There needs to be some, there's so many people that want to really, when they get out of jail, they really do want to do good. They really want to stay sober. Like, they finally made it through withdrawal. They want to make a better turn. But then they get out of jail and all that's there are drug dealers. There's no one there saying, hey, you want to go to a clean and sober house? Do you want to try this? Do you want to try that? There's nothing like that. It's all straight back into the fentanyl field. They don't, there's no help to get you from point A to point B. And if your brain isn't as good as everyone else's, you know, that step from getting out of jail to the clean and sober house or to a treatment program is a very difficult one to make.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah. Thank you.
That was KBOO reporter Sam Bowman speaking with Portland activist Tracy Molina. A full version of this interview is about three times as long and can be found on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we have on Ellie Krug as our guest. Ellie, welcome to Transpositive.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you. It's so nice to have you on the show. So, Ellie, you're the host of the radio program, The Illegal Trans Woman, and you're also a big advocate and activist in the transgender community. So first of all, can you tell us about your radio show, The Illegal Trans Woman?
Well, so let me back up before I tell you about the show. I'll tell you what I've been doing on the radio and you'll get an idea. So I started as a radio host on AM 950 in the Twin Cities. It's one of the few remaining progressive radio stations in the country. At one time it aired Air America, that had Rachel Maddow on it, and Al Franken and some other folks who went on and did other greater things. I started in 2016 with a show around surviving the human condition called Heated Edges. And after a year of that, I then changed the format to a show about idealism titled Ellie 2.0 Radio, which is about the second iteration of my life where I finally got to live as me, as a woman, but also as an idealist, something I couldn't do before when I was suppressing my gender identity. And we ran Ellie 2.0 Radio from 2017 until the Friday after the presidential election in November. And on that day, I announced that I was ending Ellie 2.0 Radio, and that on the next Friday, I would be launching a brand new show, The Illegal Trans Woman. And that show is a direct response to Donald Trump being elected president and to Project 2025. The show takes its name, actually, from Project 2025, which seeks to make quote-unquote gender ideology, whatever the heck that is, illegal. And in essence, seeks to make transgender people illegal and to erase us. So the show is a full-throated show around advocating for the trans and gender expansive communities and pushing back at the Trump regime and its efforts to erase trans people.
Great, thanks. Before we get too much further into it, where can people find your show, Ellie?
So they can go, all they have to do is Google The Illegal Trans Woman, and they'll be able to find it on AM 950. You can find the podcast because it airs on Saturday afternoons and then goes to podcast after that. So wherever you get your podcast, Spotify or wherever, you can just Google or search for The Illegal Trans Woman and you'll be able to find it.
As a podcaster and as a media producer, can you talk about the role that podcasting and media production plays in the raising of awareness around transgender issues?
Well, you know, as we certainly found with the 2024 election, podcasts are instrumental in conveying messaging. More and more people, it could be said that Donald Trump won the 2024 election. That's assuming he won it legally without cheating, because of his ability to reach out through the masculine-oriented, conservative, white nationalist type podcasts. And so, you know, on my end, and generally for anyone, okay, podcasts are an incredible way to get your messaging out. You have a lot of people that are in cars, or you have people that are taking walks, and they want to have something in their ear as they're driving. And podcasts are a great way for them to become informed. So we need more of them. My goal is to try and elevate this podcast, The Illegal Trans Woman, from something relatively obscure at the moment to something that will have a much bigger footprint.
But I mean, your show has a really good tracking as far as I can tell. I mean, I see some of the guests that you've had on. You've had people who write for the New York Times. You have all kinds of advocates. I mean, you have a significant pool of resources to bring to your show and to help educate the community. Your show must be having quite an impact in the Midwest and beyond.
Well, I appreciate that. You're right. I mean, we've had Jamel Bowie, a columnist for New York Times. We've had, I'm forgetting her name, a sports writer for the USA Today. I've had a couple of academics on to talk about research. Recently, I had on a behavioral psychologist to talk about social isolation and how people need to take risks in order to become familiar with those who are other. And then when they take those risks, they actually enjoy those experiences. And that's very important because transgender people are considered, quote unquote, other here in our society. But the problem is that there are so many outlets out there competing for attention. And, you know, as far as my show goes, I do have the backing of a radio station with a professional producer But, you know, he's also producing a bunch of other shows, not just The Illegal Trans Woman. And so there's, you know, a lot falls on Ellie Krug's shoulders. And at the moment, Ellie Krug is multiple things other than just simply a podcast or a radio show podcast host. I would love, absolutely love to make that my, you know, day in and day out avocation. But at this point where I'm in my life, I can't do that. I am lucky though that there's a station out of Chicago, WTTO, Patty Vasquez show, out of Chicago that has picked me up for once a month to come in and do some commentary, supposedly for 15 minutes, although a couple weeks ago I was on for an hour because she kept getting callers wanting to talk to me. So that was great.
You mentioned that there's a lot more to Ellie Krug than just being a radio show host. Tell me a little bit more about yourself outside of your role as a radio show host.
Well, the Reader's Digest version, Emma, is that I have the dubious distinction of being the very first lawyer in Iowa to ever transition genders. I did that in 2009 when I had a civil trial practice. And, you know, 2009 was a time where transgender people weren't very visible. I ended up losing my law firm. And then subsequent to that, moved to the Twin Cities. I was living in Cedar Rapids, Iowa at the time. I moved to the Twin Cities to start all over again. Subsequently founded a legal access nonprofit, ran that for 5 years. I ended up writing a memoir, Getting to Wellen, a memoir about love, honesty, and gender change that's still on Amazon, still, you know, selling. And then though, beginning in 2009, I had started speaking about what it meant to be trans because, as I said, trans people weren't very visible back then. And people were like, what's a transgender? Come talk to us. And from that sprang this incredible experience of me becoming a national speaker on not only how to be welcoming to trans and gender expansive people and queer people in general, but also a speaker on human inclusivity. And I have a workshop called Gray Area Thinking that I've given more than 600 times across North America that isn't queer focused, trans focused. It's human focused. People really love that workshop. So eventually I ended up leaving my nonprofit and started speaking exclusively and writing, of course, across North America, as I said. And my work was very well received. But unfortunately, when the anti-DEI, anti-wokeism movement began, starting with Ruffalo, I don't remember his first name, starting to attack it in late 2021, early 2022, that movement, of course, now has taken hold. It's the official position of the federal government that there'll be no such thing as DEI, which has chilled that work across the country. And so my speaking has taken quite a hit. So has my paycheck. So unfortunately, that's where I'm at right now. I have the double whammy of both doing inclusivity work and being transgender. It's like the two things that nobody wants in their organization.
Ellie, you mentioned earlier that you're from Iowa and you're a lawyer and you were the first transgender lawyer from the state of Iowa. About 2 months ago, Iowa voted to deny transgender people their basic civil and human rights. And this was actually a vote taken by the Iowa State Legislature. Can you explain what motivated this action by the Iowa State Legislature to deny trans people their civil and human rights?
Well, they removed protection for transgender people from the state civil rights statute. Okay, it wasn't, there's no protection for civil rights protection in the Constitution in Iowa. Well, I'll tell you what happened. Iowa, for a very long time, I grew up in Cedar Rapids, and Iowa, for a very long time, was known for two things, three things. One, it was known for corn, okay? Secondly, it was known for its education programs. And third, it was known as a state that would take in refugees and that was welcoming to people who were from other countries, immigrants. So after the Vietnam War, Iowa took in, at the behest of its then governor, Bob Rae, took in thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia. And you know, community groups and churches and everything. It was, you know, I mean, it was a conservative state, but it was also had a huge humanitarian and liberal bend in many ways. And in the mid-80s, it had a Democratic governor and a democratically controlled legislature. That's where they passed the state civil rights law to protect LGBTQ people, including trans people. And in 2009, the Iowa Supreme Court became, I think, the third Supreme Court to rule unanimously in favor of same-sex marriage, okay, of marriage equality. And so that ruling came out in April of 2009, and I came out as Ellie Krug in May of 2009. It was like a great time, you know, to be queer, to certainly be transgender, because people were far more accepting. Then there was a backlash. So there was a conservative backlash beginning after the marriage case. And in Iowa, the Supreme Court justices, they're not elected, they are appointed, but they are subject to a thing called retention. And that means every 6 years, three out of the whatever number it is on the Supreme Court, justices have to stand for retention. And usually all that means is, you know, unless there's like a percentage of voters that want to vote the Supreme Court justices out, they just stay, you know, Supreme Court justices. Well, in 2010, in fall of 2010, when a year after the Supreme Court had issued this marriage decision, there was a very concerted conservative movement to essentially fire the three Supreme Court justices who would be up, including the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And that movement was very successful. They removed the three Supreme Court justices. That in turn chilled the entire state judiciary on many things related to civil rights, certainly many things related to LGBTQ topics. And that also gave confidence and impetus to other conservative movements within the state. And thus, you know, the Tea Party was going on around that time, and the state started gradually to become politically more conservative. And it just snowballed to the extent now that the state is not only Republican-controlled legislature and a governor who fashions herself as a MAGA wannabe, but you've got a legislature that is a MAGA wannabe. And they are hell-bent, not only on going after trans and queer people, but they're hell-bent on going after anything that relates to anything DEI. I mean, they cut back on SNAP benefits. That's formerly known as food stamps. They've passed a voucher system for private schools, mainly private religious schools, that have drawn away thousands of students from the public school system and taken money away from the public school system. So now Iowa, still known for corn, but no longer known certainly as being welcoming and no longer known as a high education state. I think they've gone from number two or three in the country to they're down somewhere in the 30s now. So that's what's happened. And I wanted to go back. I have Iowa dirt in my blood. I mean, I considered myself an Iowan, and I wanted to go back to Iowa to live. Take my last breath. I'm, you know, what am I, 60? In the 2020 election. I was going to be 60. I was 63 years old. And so, you know, I'm like, hey, I want the last chapter to be in Iowa. But when I saw the election results in Iowa, which included the legislature becoming even more Republican and the state Republican legislative leaders saying that the Republicans now have a mandate in Iowa and they're going to use it. You know, if you're queer and you hear the word mandate come out of the mouth of a Republican, you know that they're going to be coming after you. And that's exactly what has happened.
So if you were to go back to Iowa today, what is the status of right for transgender Iowans? I mean, what?
No rights.
What kind of?
Nope.
What does that mean?
Technically, under the Supreme Court ruling in Bostock in 2015, transgender Iowans can't be fired from their jobs. Although I don't look for the EEOC, the current EEOC, to do anything to try and enforce that. So transgender Iowans right now are at the mercy, literally the mercy of whomever they encounter. Landlords are free to discriminate against them, and they're credit bureaus are free, or, you know, banks and whatever who issue credit are free to discriminate against them. Schools are free to discriminate against them. I'm going to assume, that we don't even have in Iowa, they're not even going to, medical providers are free to discriminate. I mean, you know, you've got the interplay between the state and the federal. I mean, the federal government, of course, is going in the opposite direction as well. So it's horrible.
Do you think that that's how most Iowans feel? I just ask because, you know, my grandmother is from Iowa, so I'm personally interested in this story. And, you know, when I've been to Iowa, it seems like people there are nice. So, I mean, do you think that they want to discriminate against transgender people? Is that important to them?
No, I don't. But I think that people in power and people who have religious bends that are conservative certainly do. And so, you know, people take their cue, but it's not only about being discriminated against, it's about being afraid. You know, you create this atmosphere of intolerance and then this atmosphere of maybe retribution. People are, you know, are even afraid to be allies or to be supporters. So now I know, I mean, the state house was occupied by a lot of queer people, you know, when they were debating the bill, whether to remove trans protections from the state civil rights statute. On my radio show, I had this lovely pastor, Pastor Luke, from the United Church of Christ in Des Moines, who talked about a unified effort by the churches to, you know, convince legislators not to remove trans protections from the civil rights statute. And I know, you know, that the churches and the communities, the faith communities there, will still be welcoming to trans people. But the problem is that, you know, Iowa's a big state. You know, Des Moines is liberal. Cedar Rapids, maybe sort of liberal. Iowa City, very liberal. But you start getting out into the country, you go to Sioux City or Mason City or Fort Dodge, you know, that's a whole different ballgame. And that's where the discrimination is going to happen. And that's where trans and gender variant people have been and will continue to be afraid to come out, to be who they are. And if they don't have the resources to move to the big city, they're pretty well stuck. And they're at the mercy of people who will be intolerant.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible.
Now you live in Minnesota. How is Minnesota for transgender rights?
Minnesota is a refuge state here. So we have a transgender representative in our state house, Lee Finke. She quickly introduced a bill to make Iowa or to make Minnesota a transgender refuge state. That bill passed 2 years ago. And so in Minnesota, and this is why I live in Minnesota, trust me, okay, it's not for the weather. I have rights on top of rights. So I am protected in all aspects of everything. And we have a state attorney general who is very trans friendly. and who, by the way, I'm going to be training his office on Trends 101 for Legal Professionals in early May. You know, we have an ACLU. I sat for breakfast or for lunch on Monday with the Minnesota ACLU executive director, and who I know is very trans friendly. And we have a number of other organizations that are advocates for trans people. Now, it's a totally different atmosphere here. You know, the Twin Cities, a metropolitan area of about 3 million people. I mean, you'll walk into a bookstore, you're going to find a human with a beard wearing a dress. Okay, you will. And everybody's like, oh, no big deal. In Iowa, that person would get their head bashed in the wrong place.
So if it's okay, I'd like to switch gears for a minute. And I'd like to move on and talk about transgender teens. Recently, the United States had a Supreme Court case called Scrimeti. I believe it was Scrimeti versus Tennessee. Or it might be Scrimeti versus U.S. Anyways, we've had a couple of people on the show so far to talk about Scrimeti. It's a foundational landmark piece having to do with transgender civil rights. And I was just wondering if, as a lawyer, if you could comment on Scrimeti, on the case, and what you think the impact of the outcome of a Scrimeti decision will be for the transgender community, and specifically for transgender teens.
So the issue in Scrimeti is whether it is violative of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment to... in the Due Process Clause in the 14th Amendment to prohibit trans kids and youth from accessing gender-affirming care, okay? The state claims that it has a legitimate interest in, quote-unquote, protecting those young humans because the state claims that gender-affirming care is irreversible, you know, and that, you know, of course, they bring in the detransitioners and all of that stuff to claim that, you know, this is a horrible thing, bearing in mind that it's a minuscule percentage of trans kids and youth across the nation who access gender-affirming care, but put that aside, all right? And so the state is essentially claiming that we have the right to occupy the space that parents would otherwise have, and I'm concerned that that the Supreme Court will also buy an argument that the class of transgender people is so minusculely small it shouldn't be considered a protected class for purposes of constitutional protection, constitutional rights. Now, I have no doubt Scrimeti is going to come down in an unfavorable way to the transgender community. I don't have any doubt about it. I don't have any doubt that they're going to side with the state of Tennessee. I don't have any doubt that, I think that it's just a matter of what they say in their decision, but some of that won't even matter. I'm sure you're familiar with the affirmative action case that came down in 2022 relating just to college affirmative action around the admission of giving some preferential treatment to the admission of students of color to try and make up for, you know, 200 plus years of enslaving Black people and people of other skin colors and indigenous people. And in that case, the Supreme Court essentially said that violates federal law if you provide any kind of, you know, leg up in the admissions process. You take that into consideration in the admissions process that the skin color or marginalized background of a student. That was just all that was, okay? That was just simply an affirmative action case for college admissions. But what the conservative movement has done is they've just taken that case and they've just translated that to all kinds of other things, you know, to the way that nonprofits operate relative to handing out grants, to the way businesses operate relative to their DEI programs. Now, some of the DEI cases are also based on a statute that dates back to, I think, 1866 or 1867. But nonetheless, they're throwing in, they're doing their best to expand that affirmative action case to things that have nothing to do with higher education. My concern is that when the Supreme Court announces Scrimeti, even though it would only be related to, you know, the distinct issue of gender affirming care in Tennessee for trans kids and trans youth, I'm concerned and predict that conservative elements will just use that as an open door to wholesale discriminate against transgender people across the country. I mean, let's face it. I mean, trans people only have legal rights in, I don't know, 22 states in DC. Maybe it's 21 now, I don't know, since we lost Iowa. But I mean, we don't have legal rights in the majority of the states of the country. And so, I mean, already, you know, there's a lot of discrimination going against transgender people. But I anticipate that conservative forces will use this to even attack transgender rights in blue states where we're protected. And certainly give impetus to the federal government, to Congress, to start passing even more laws. You know, they weren't able to do it with the sports ban. Thank God the Senate held firm. But I mean, we're only, what, 2 months into the Trump administration? I mean, they're going to keep coming back again and again against us.
One of the one of the justices in Scrimeti made the argument that transgender people don't, basically they made the argument that transgender people don't have a history yet as a protected class in the way that women and people of color and religious minorities have historically established their identities as a protected class, and that it's not even really clear right now what being transgender is. Is it gender fluid? Is it gender non-binary? Is it transgender? That seemed to be one of the arguments that was made in the hearings that seemed to stick. Can you comment on the concept of protected class for gender identity? And how can we establish that as a historic precedent?
Well, I mean, trans, as you and I both know, trans people have been around forever, okay? I mean, you know, centuries and centuries and centuries, trans people have been around. I think the question came from Gorsuch, the Justice Gorsuch. The problem is that a lot of people in power have never met a transgender person. They have no idea about what it means to be trans. No idea whatsoever. And then that was reflected by the Supreme Court. And so if you've never met a transgender people, you have no person, you have no idea about the challenges somebody has gone through in fighting a binary society, you know, with gender assigned at birth. And then they have no idea about what it means that people get wired a different way. I mean, you know, Emma, I don't know about you, okay, but the way I describe it is, you know, human authenticity will not leave you alone until you listen to it. Humans are wired in different ways for their authenticity. It's not only about gender and sexuality. I mean, there are some people, you know, that they've got to play music, and if they don't play music, they're going to go into deep depression, okay? And so authenticity shows up in a variety of ways. I don't know how I got wired this way. I also got wired left-handed. Okay, I did. And so I'm not going to fight being left-handed. Similarly, I'm not going to fight that my brain didn't accept my body. And this is the problem, okay? This is the problem that we as a community generally have. People don't know us. They've never sat and talked with a trans person who hear at all about the struggles that they've gone through. Am I right? Right? We've all struggled. I mean, we all have that in common. And then we have a whole society that believes that being trans or non-binary, pick your choice, is a choice, you know, that that they believe that being trans is a choice, that you really don't have to be that way. I mean, gosh, I heard that when I transitioned at age 52. Are you sure you're really trans? You look like you were so happy as a guy. My mother-in-law, God love her, but I lost her. You know, she said, well, you chose to be you. I'm going to choose not to accept you. Boom. There you go. That was it. And that was the last time I ever talked to my ex-mother-in-law, who I really adored. And so, yeah. And this choice thing, I've got, just so I can, you know, square the circle here, this choice thing is something that my work is about right now. That's why I'm going and speaking to the Minnesota Attorney General's office. That's why I did a Trans 101 for the Minnesota ACLU. That's why I'm trying to offer up my Trans 101 for legal professionals to Attorney General's offices and ACLU offices across the country to help educate people first on how, what it means to be trans. And then secondly, for them to give them a tool when people say, oh, it's just a choice to be who they are, because I've got a tool for people on how they can address that. And so it's not a choice, but as long as people continue to believe it's a choice, because we don't have people believing that being Black is a choice. We don't have people believing that being Native is choice. And even now in the 2010s or 2020s, we have people that no longer believe being gay or lesbian is a choice. Emma, I don't know how far we are apart in age, but, you know, assuming you were alive and breathing and fairly, you know, astute, you will remember that in the 70s and the 80s and even into the 90s, the claim was, you don't have to be gay. It's just a choice. And then it went to, well, okay, you can be gay, but you can choose not to have sex. Do you remember that stuff?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in 2025, I think much of society has come to accept, nah, you're born that way. Okay, it's not a choice. But with us, it's a choice. And I think part of the reason people have such a difficult time with this choice thing is because when we transition, we like transition. You know, it's new name, new pronouns, new appearance, you know, new clothing, new hair, the whole works. You know, and I think that that's far more difficult for people to wrap their heads around than if some guy comes out as gay. You know, because there's no work with the guy that's come out as gay. Well, I mean, maybe he's going to wear a more fashionable hairdo and maybe a nicer t-shirt. But apart from that, there's no work in recognizing this person as being gay. With trans people, there's a lot of work.
It seems like the groundwork that began the current assault on transgender rights really began in North Dakota about 4 or 5 years ago, when North Dakota began introducing legislation that got modeled across the country, primarily going after trans kids. And we just talked about the Scrimeti case. Can you help me understand, how do we talk to parents and adults who have children or who care for children about why it matters to acknowledge their gender identity, to let them explore their gender identity? What do we say to people who make accusations that we're groomers, or that we're supporting social contagion? As much as I hate to use those two words, those are words that they use against us. How do we address parents who maybe don't understand the issues, don't know that much about them, and they're listening to Fox News and right-wing radio for all their information? How do we talk to them?
Well, there's a couple of ways that I talk with them about that. First is I try and talk with them about the idea that humans are wired differently. You know, that they, you know, when they were 1 year old, they didn't know that they'd have this avocation that they, you know, needed to be a fisher person, okay? You know, 14 times, you know, in a week, they had to go out on the boat. Okay, that's a part of human authenticity, to be out in nature, that, you know, catching fish. I mean, it's something that's core to who, what their existence is. Well, they didn't know that when they were 1 year old. And so the same thing is that, you know, we don't know when we're born, but we get assigned this thing about gender identity, you know, our gender assigned at birth simply based on, you know, anatomy. That's assuming you're not, you know, intersex, but, and so one of the ways I talk with them about it is that, you know, you just don't know who you are or what you are until you start to get older. And it's back to the wiring about the left-handedness. I mean, I do talk to them about left-handedness and like, you know, how many of you in this room are left-handed? How many of you chose to be left-handed? Nobody's going to ever choose to be left-handed. And so that's just about the way that things get wired. On the social contagion thing, you know, I mean, I'm going to tell you, and maybe you or your listeners aren't going to want to hear this, but I'm not going to discount that there isn't some bandwagon effect, okay? I mean, I'm not going to discount that, you know, somebody's got maybe one or two trans friends and, you know, suddenly they're starting to wonder, maybe they're trans, maybe they want to try it out. But what the key is consistent gender identification over time. That's the phrase that I use with parents. That's the phrase I use with therapists and with doctors. Consistent gender identification over time. And you don't have, and there's no social contagion, okay, with a three-year-old who comes and says, mommy, mommy, I'm not a boy, I'm really a girl. That's not social contagion. That's just like plain up wiring, human authenticity, you know, showing you what it is. And so, but if that three-year-old keeps saying, mommy, mommy, at 5 years old, mommy, mommy, at 8 years old, mommy, mommy, at 10 years old, that's consistent gender identification over time. This is real. You got to pay attention to it. I mean, they need to start paying attention to it at age 3. But by age 10, they have to start thinking about gender-affirming care. And people are like, well, you know, why do you need to do this? Why do you have to have puberty blockers? Why, you know, why do you need to have hormones? And my response, and I'm the perfect, Emma, I am the absolute perfect poster child for gender-affirming care. Because what I say to people is, do you hear me? Do you hear my voice? You know, and the reason for gender-affirming care for puberty blockers for trans girls and trans, you know, young trans teens is it will prevent them from having this voice. And then I go on relate about, I joke around the fact how having this voice doesn't get me a date, which is sad but true. But I also talk about how this voice puts me at risk if I say the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person. So that's, all of that's one approach I take with parents of trans kids, gender queer kids. But I am not above using the mercenary approach. Do you know what the mercenary approach is?
No, what is that?
The mercenary approach is asking the parents if they know what's the magic number. And most parents are like, what are you talking about? I'm like, what's the magic number for a kid? And sooner or later, somebody's going to say 18. And I say, yep, that's right. Because at 18... your kid can, except in Alabama, it's 19. God, I don't, because it had to be Alabama. At 18, your kid can go get gender affirming care if they want to. And how you treat them from age 12 or 13 to age 18 is going to set the pattern. Here's the mercenary approach, okay? Is going to set the pattern on how they treat you after they turn 18. If you're loving and affirming and caring towards that child, once they turn 18, they're going to want to keep you in their life. But if you suppress them, if you degrade them, if you put them through hell where they consider taking their own lives, the odds are that once they turn 18, they're going to not want to have anything to do with you. And most parents, Emma, I don't think understand the magic of age 18, of becoming, you know, empowered. And so, you know, and the arguments I've just laid out for you, I'm not going to get every parent when I make those arguments, okay? But I'm going to get some. And so that's good. I'll take those some. And it's true. You know, if the parent is unloving, is uncaring, is religious, you know, suppression, all of that jazz to a trans kid as they're in their teens, early teens, that kid not going to want to have anything to do with those parents after they become adults. That's a reality. It is. And it's sad. It's sad that the parents would do that. Now, when I meet parents who are affirming to their kids, the very first thing I say to them is, thank you for loving your kid. I mean, I am like, you know, effusive about that because they need to be applauded. They need to be affirmed in the loving of their child. And it's incredibly important because you and I both know not every parent does that. Now you're getting a sense of why I do my work. Okay.
Oh, I do. Thank you. I really do. So, Ellie, I'd like to switch gears for a minute. I'd like to talk about travel documents. one of the areas of great uncertainty right now for transgender people is their travel documents. I've been hearing reports that transgender people are having their gender identities on their passports changed. If they used to say female and they're submitting an application right now, it might get reverted back to male. If they're trying to do a change of gender identity, the government's refusing to do those.
Yep.
Not to mention what's happening to non-binary people.
Yep.
How safe is it right now for transgender people to travel? And what's going on right now with travel documents?
Well, let's talk about both international and then let's talk about intra-country, okay, internally. Internationally, you know, with Trump's executive order declaring that there's only a man, you know, man and woman, and defining it as, you know, what was the reproductive cell at the moment, you know, of conception, which is crazy, crazy stuff. But in essence, though, Trump, you know, defining gender identity out of the lexicon of the entire federal government, you know, that has set into motion all kinds of things, okay? And that includes the State Department essentially saying we will not recognize transgender folks, and that if we have an inkling or an idea that you were assigned a different gender at birth, when it comes time to either get your travel document, your passport, or to update it because you have to renew it every 10 years, we're going to force you to revert. That's really what it is. It's reversion. And we're not going to give you a gender marker that is consistent with your gender identity. So, I mean, we also, Emma, need to take into account that as we speak right now, there are X number, I don't know how many countries, but X country number of countries in the world where you and me having this conversation would be considered incredibly illegal. And in some countries, you and I could be killed, like executed by the state for being who we are. So let's put aside those countries, okay? All right? But we now have, you know, a situation where Hunter Schafer, the beautiful, beautiful trans woman actress, is walking around with a passport that's got an M on it because she had her passport stolen and she had to get a replacement and they put an M on it instead of an F. And so that means that she goes into various countries. Now, she's got, you know, she's famous, and so she's got some protection that way. But if there was another, you know, another person with the name Hunter Schafer who wasn't an actress who had the same situation, she would be at risk in certain countries for being pulled aside, being questioned, being harassed for being a fraud in some way, and then being at the mercy, you know, really, of what those governments would do. I mean, if you can, you know, I mean, a lot of trans people are stealth, which of course means that they pass, which means no one would ever guess that they were assigned a different gender at birth. Hunter Schafer certainly could have done that. And, you know, then there's really no problem. Nobody's going to have a reason to question you. So I think that so that's leaving the country, okay? I think that if you're a U.S. citizen and you come back and there's some question about your passport, I think that you're setting yourself up, even if you're an American citizen, I think you're setting yourself up to some big time problems, you know, at customs. Does that mean they're going to talk to you for 10 minutes? I don't know. Does that mean they're going to do a strip search of you to figure out exactly what's going on? Maybe. I don't know. With the government that we have right now, the authoritarian regime that we have right now that seems intent on not following or pursuing or protecting any personal civil rights or liberties, I think anything is game for this federal government. And so I know trans people are traveling internationally, leaving the country, coming back. I mean, if you're a foreign national and you're coming to the US and you're transgender, don't do it. Just don't do it. Don't come. Don't even think about it. Don't do that. Now, let's talk internally though, okay? Because right now, it's a crapshoot about traveling as trans in a number of states. So in Florida, I'm sure you're familiar, you know, Florida DMV has declared that, you know, the gender marker on your driver's license has to be consistent with the gender assigned at birth. They're calling on Floridians, trans Floridians, to turn in their driver's license to revert back. And in Florida, under DMV regulations, you can be charged with criminal fraud if you're stopped and found that your gender marker does not match the gender assigned at birth, okay? So if you're driving as trans, you go 10 miles over the speed limit, you don't pass like Ellie Krug, and you got a trooper that's like, I don't like transgender people, I don't like queer people, okay, you know, I'm in trouble, all right? Texas, as you may know, okay, Greg Abbott, and then Ken Paxton, the attorney general down there, the transphobic attorney general. And by the way, we always know that people who are so transphobic, what do we know about them, Emma? But we won't go there, okay? But he has mandated that court orders directing the state DMV to change gender markers will be ignored. So you have an attorney general saying that an order from the court will not be adhered to in Texas. And they're also not allowing birth certificates to be changed as well, okay, with court orders mandating that. And they too are starting down the road, the reversion road for transgender Texans. They're trying to put together a database of all the transgender Texans so they can do all kinds of things to that group of humans. So, you know, I will not go to Florida. Okay, you come to me and you want to give me a speaking fee to go down to Florida, I'm not going to do it. You want me to do it online? Sure. Okay, but I'm not going to Florida. And I probably am not going to go to Texas. Okay, now the question will be, how many more states by this time next year will be following those paths? And then the bigger question is, will the federal government, will Congress, through the Department of Transportation mechanism, require that states order reversion for transgender drivers back to original gender markers? Because what at one time, you know, you didn't have to wear a seatbelt in America. How did the seatbelt use come into play? Because the Department of Transportation, U.S. Department of Transportation said, we're not going to give you any more dollars to fix your highways unless you pass state laws mandating seatbelt use. The same with the fact that every state now, the blood alcohol content for drunk driving is 0.08. It used to be 0.10. In some states, it was 0.12. Okay, nope. Department of Transportation said no federal dollars for construction unless everyone goes to 0.08. Same thing they could do now with trans people and driver's licenses. And Emma, these people have great imaginations. They do. I wouldn't put it past them.
So, Elliot, I'd like to, in the last few minutes of the show, I'd like to introduce a little positivity.
I know. Call me Debbie Downer.
No, it's No, you're very, this has been a great interview. We've been talking today with Ellie Krug, the host of The Illegal Trans Woman, and also an activist, a lawyer, an advocate for transgender folks and for DEI. Ellie, recently we celebrated Transgender Day of Visibility, just a little more than a month ago. Can you tell me, what does being visible and out mean to you?
Well, before this year, TGDOV meant to me, you know, just about being proud about who I am and about understanding that trans people are, we have the rights and the right to be who we are, just like everybody else. It also stood for me for compassion, because part of my work, although maybe you may not have picked up on that in the last hour, but a large chunk of my work is about sharing about the need to have compassion for all humans, not just trans people, but all humans. And, you know, and then about talking about the need for compassion for trans folks on the Day of Visibility, but also for all humans as well. But in 2025, Transgender Day of Visibility is about resistance. You know, and I know you want to end on a positive note here, okay? And I will tell you this. I live in a red county outside the Twin Cities, a red to purple county. I live on a street filled with white, cis, straight, old people who have retired, okay? They all like me. They all accept me. I got elected to the local school board, for crying out loud, okay?
Congratulations.
No, thanks. I'm not saying that to be braggadocious. I'm saying it to make the point that people can get past. They can get past the prejudice. They can get past the fear. That's really what it is. It's really about fear. They can get that. But the only way that's going to happen is if they get to know us. That's the only way. It's not going to work without becoming familiar with us. And that puts the burden on us. And when people, they may not be, you know, if you want to erase me, we're not going to have a conversation. Okay. If you're like, you don't deserve the right to live, we're not going to have a conversation. But if somebody comes to me and says, I don't know about that sports, you know, trans girls playing sports, I really don't know about that. Or, you know, I get uncomfortable about the bathroom thing, you know, for me, the reaction is not to say, oh my God, okay, how could you say that? My reaction is to say, come on, let's have a conversation. Let me talk about that. You know, when's the last time you saw somebody's the color of somebody's underwear in the women's restroom? They're going to like, never, okay? You know, and so we can come along and have conversations and bring people along. We can do that. And so that's compassion and that's openness. But right now in 2025, Transgender Day of Visibility is about resisting the Trump regime and about marshaling everything that we have as a community, including our allies, which are hit or miss, and preventing us from being erased. And in my book, that means being killed.
We've been talking today with Ellie Krug, the host of The Illegal Trans Woman. Ellie, if people would like to find out more about you or more about your show and your work as a DEI speaker, and all the great things that you do, where can they go to find out more about you?
They could go to elliekrug.com, E-L-L-I-E-K-R-U-G, elliekrug.com. There's a whole website there. They can sign up for my newsletter that goes out to 9,000 people. That's about compassion and how humans are good to each other. Or sign up for my new Substack blog, Being Ellen, Advocacy with Heart. That's full-throated advocacy for our community in writing. I would love for people to do that.
Great. Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you on our show, Ellie. Thank you so much for joining us today on Trans Positive.
Thank you, Emma, for having me. It's been a pleasure. I've really appreciated it.
transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Listening to KBOO Portland.